Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. On November 11th, 1918, 100 years ago yesterday, the Great War, or as it became known, World War I, came to an end. More than 35 million people died in the war, including around 120,000 Americans. World War I was a conflict that significantly changed how wars were fought, introduced new weapons, altered borders, and led directly to World War II. But yet, it has never gotten as much attention as most other wars that involved the United States. We're going to discuss the end of World War I and the war itself today with our guest, Dr. Conrad Crane. He's currently Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle, part of the U.S. Army War College. Dr. Crane, good to see you again.
Very glad to be here.
Also joining us is Dr. Doug Mastriano. He's a historian and author, actually author of the book on Alvin York, World War I hero. Dr. Mastriano, good to see you too.
Thank you, Scott. It's great to be back.
All right, so let's talk about November 11th, 1918, 100 years ago yesterday. What happened that day?
On the 11th hour of the 11th day, on the 11th month of 1918, the Great War ended. And we're pushing 11, 12 million casualties around the world with the Spanish flu outbreak. We don't even know how many died with that. But thus ends this great cataclysm. The Germans sent over a group of negotiators a few days before, and around 5:30 in the morning on the 11th of November, there was an agreement to have an armistice to end the war. It would be, of course, followed with the Treaty of Versailles. Word went out to the units around 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning, but yet the Americans, French, and British continued to attack. And in the last 5 hours of the war, it's estimated there's about 11,000 casualties, over 3,000 of those American.
Armistice. I mean, that doesn't sound like the end of a war. That sounds like something temporary.
And that was the view of many of the Allied commanders, such as Pershing. Pershing, his position was because he had to stand before Congress and testify. Congress said, why did so many men die? Even, of course, Private Gunter from Baltimore, who died at 10:59. Why did you do this? We knew the war was ending, and Pershing's position was like, well, it was an armistice. It wasn't a treaty to end the war. And so if it started again, we'd be in a better position.
You mentioned General Pershing. And he was head of the American forces in Europe at that time. Tell me a little bit about John Pershing.
Yeah, General Pershing was offered command by President Wilson because of his, I wouldn't call success, but his operations against Pancho Villa and the Mexican border, where my great-grandfather was part of that chasing Pancho Villa, and we never got him. But Pershing was offered command. And he was given a tough job. He had to expand the army from just over 200,000 to 4 million in 2 years and to get these guys ready for combat and then to fight a modern war.
Dr. Crane, you kind of went, huh, when I mentioned now, Pershing.
Now, Pershing, he is the iconic leader of the era. Historians are very hard on Pershing because of his, he was the organizational skills. He did a great job growing the army, but he was very hard-headed about learning from his allies. And as Doug has written about so much about the very rough American tactics they use, the unnecessary casualties we take, he doesn't really accomplish his mission, which is to create he does help win the war, but he doesn't do it in such a way that gives Woodrow Wilson the leverage at the Versailles peace table that he wanted.
What kind of leverage did he want?
Well, he wanted, of course, remember, Wilson has the 14 points. He has a vision of a peace treaty that's fairly gentle, that resolves issues without creating long-term enmity. And of course, the peace treaty we end up with is very punitive and lays a lot of the roots for World War II. But again, he doesn't have the leverage with the Allies because they, and we can talk about the great contribution the American forces make, at the same time, the Allies don't. They don't give it enough importance where Wilson has the voice at the peace table he really wants. It's the British and the French that are going to really run the peace negotiations and not the Americans.
Scott, it's so bad that the French and British are sending military advisors in 1917 to help the Americans get ready for war. And Pershing basically tells his commanders, don't listen to them. They don't know how to do this. We're Americans, and we're going to win this with the rifle and the bayonet. And the French say, well, we lost 250,000 men in the first 2 weeks of the war in 1914. That was a bad idea. We tried that. Here's the way to fight. And George Clemenceau, the premier of France, was so frustrated at Pershing's hard-headedness and refusal to learn from the previous 3 years of war that George Clemenceau said of the Americans, well, if they refuse to learn from the French, the Germans will teach them. And I have statements in my new book, Thunder in the Argonne, from the German side. They actually feel bad that they're killing so many Americans. They're basically saying, why are the Americans fighting a 1914 war in 1918?
But yet, when I look back at a biography of General Pershing, I see that he's hailed as a hero at the time by the public. He was awarded a Distinguished Service Cross. Now, we have a history of doing that in America, but you know, why did the public think, and what did the people back home, the leaders, think of General Pershing's performance?
I mean, he lives until the 1940s, so he's around a long time. I mean, he influenced the whole series of leaders. I mean, Douglas MacArthur idolized Pershing, modeled himself after him in many ways. He had a great influence on a lot of the upcoming leaders. And so in that, he mentored a lot of these people throughout the interwar years as well. So he has a major influence shaping future leaders. And, of course, the Americans love a hero, and he becomes the iconic figure for the victory. You know, Lafayette, we are here, and whatever whether he said that or not. But I mean, so he there's a certain amount of image that he's very good at fostering that image as well. And we did, we did win the war. I mean, yeah, we could have done it better. We could have done a fewer casualties, but we did win. I mean, we could say that as much as disillusionment kicks in later with the results of the war, you know, it's not the blame is much more on the politicians and others, and not so much on the military at that time.
All right, so let's go back to November 11th, and I ask what happened, and you talked about the armistice, Doug, but what was the result of that armistice? What occurred afterwards that we feel even to this day?
Well, what was clear is the war really did end on that day, even if it was an armistice. As Germans began withdrawing, they left behind all the heavy weapons that they promised the Allies, especially the French, that they would not take this back. But then the German army marches back home, and the German people are like, what's going on here? The officers are on horseback oftentimes, and it looks much like as when they left in 1914, and it does not look like a defeated army. So this bears fruit in World War II with unconditional surrender. So next time we fight the Germans, and then later on the Japanese, who are actually allies in World War I, we're going to have to beat them down, and it'll be unconditional. There'll be no conditions, so there'll be not another perception that the Germans were stabbed in the back and not defeated on the battlefield. They were defeated, but it wasn't a complete defeat.
So that was a lesson. My question was about lessons learned. Lessons learned for World War II was it had to be an unconditional surrender, had to be a defeat.
Complete. And in fact, on the enemy's home turf. So, yeah, in Japan, we were only on a few of the islands that were in Saipan, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa that were really considered home turf. But American troops occupied Japan. So it's like, we're here, you lost. In World War I, it was just the Rhineland. The rest of Germany was not occupied by any Allied forces.
So, okay, well, there are other factors that as a result of World War I, some politically, especially in Europe, especially with Germany. I mean, everyone, when they think of maybe not historians, but many people, when they think about World War I, and the German side, think of Kaiser Wilhelm. But there was more to it than that, and it led to the rise of Adolf Hitler going into World War II.
Well, there's mass chaos in Germany afterwards. I mean, of course, the myth that, like Doug referred to, that springs up that Hitler will propagate is that we never were defeated in the field. It's just that the public support wilted. And if the German people had stayed behind the war effort, it would have continued, we could have won. So that's one of the reasons why there's so much propaganda, and Hitler worked so hard to keep the German state together, and dissent is completely crushed and everything like that. But it's a very punitive peace treaty. Heavy reparations on the Germans. Everybody wants to keep the Germans down. You end up with, of course, you have the economic collapse of the late 20s, early 30s, which were the worldwide depression, which, the Weimar Republic is a very weak democracy. We tend to forget that Hitler is elected, that he comes up, that this Weimar democracy is what brings Adolf Hitler to power, enables him to do what he wants to do. But he does that telling the German people, I'm going to bring you out of this depression. I'm going to get over. We're going to recover from the ignominy of losing World War I, restore our rightful place in the world, and take revenge on all these people that have punished us for our transgressions in World War I with reparations.
It's truly a graveyard of dynasties. The Austro-Hungarian Habsburg dynasty ends in 1918. Of course, Kaiser Wilhelm has to step down. The Hohenzollern dynasty, which isn't very old, by the way, goes back to 1870, the Franco-Prussian War. He has to step down. The Romanovs collapse the year before in Russia with the Soviet rise. And then, of course, the Ottomans. And in this vacuum, many of the wars and conflicts and areas of friction and concern for the United States strategically are born from either 1916 or 1918. Iraq and Syria never existed until after World War II. World War One. And this is as a result of the Sykes-Picot Treaty that the French and British decided secretly to divide up. The modern borders of all of Eastern and Northern Europe, the existence of Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the rebirth of Lithuania, the birth of Latvia and Estonia and the conflict with Russia that we might have there goes to 1918. The borders of Ukraine, modern Ukraine and Poland, roughly go back to 1918, of course, adjusted in 1945. But this is a big deal and is very relevant to American policy today.
And we can't forget that there's this is truly a world war. There are major restructuring in Africa as the British and the French take over the German possessions. One we tend to forget, the Japanese jump into the war on the Allied side and take over the German possessions in the Pacific, and a lot of those islands, especially the Carolines, that the Japanese take in the latter part of World War One, we're going to be fighting through to get to Japan in the 1940s.
So, you know, this is such a great history lesson because in those 100 years, so much has happened in American history. So much attention tends to go toward World War II. And now, even in recent years, I say recent years, the last 50 years, Vietnam, maybe even Korea. But, you know, what the wars that the United States has fought in the last 60 years as compared to looking back those 100 years. Why? Why do you think World War I, 35 million deaths? Why do you think World War I doesn't get the kind of attention that it should with that many people dying?
Yeah, it's very frustrating. I just came back from Europe, spent a month there and participating in several commemorations for the centennial of World War I there, especially, of course, Alvin York. But the silence on this side of the ocean, the French and British, the Belgians are commemorating that, but the silence here is a bit frustrating. Because to understand our current situation in the world and many of the problems we have, they're rooted in 1918. And I think it's overshadowed by a lot of factors. One, of course, is it was an incomplete result. And I believe, as a historian, I say World War II is just a completion of World War I. It was just a pause in the middle to rearm, refit, retrain, recruit, and go again. But the other thing that strikes me, of course, is World War II is so much more dramatic. You have atomic bombs and blitzkrieg and just masses of men and ships and naval engagements, Battle of Midway, of course, Pearl Harbor. And these are overshadowing 1918 Meuse Argonne.
We have a lot more to talk about concerning World War I. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking on this day after Veterans Day in 2018 about what happened 100 years ago yesterday on November 11th, 1918, the end of World War I, the Great War, as it was known. Other people started calling it the war to end all wars. And we'll talk about that in just a few minutes as well. Our guest today, Dr. Doug Mastriano, who is a historian and author. Dr. Conrad Crane, currently Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center, part of the U.S. Army War College. All right, so I want to play something for you. There's a Centennial Commission on World War I, and this goes to the lack of attention that World War I has gotten. This is just a clip from a trailer having to do with trying to get a World War I memorial established.
By itself, World War I did not, could not, make the world safe for democracy. Liberty must always be defended, strengthened, and cherished. Millions of Americans served this cause. 116,516 doughboys made the ultimate sacrifice. Today, in our nation's capital, every major American war fought in defense of freedom is honored with a national memorial, save World War I.
Doug, why not?
It's just been forgotten, the history. So America comes out of 1918, and as Conrad mentioned, of course, there was a bit of disillusionment. It's like we violated American tradition, got entangled in European affairs, as George Washington warned us not to with his farewell address. And we go over there, and then by the 30s, it seems like we're back at the starting point. And in fact, there's a famous slogan that a lot of people who are advocating intervention and preparation for war, the rebuff is, we did that last time, and what did that get you? And so the idea is, you know, World War One, maybe we shouldn't have done it. But without us, the British and French could not have won. Even British historians who often detract from the American contribution will say that after the Battle of Verdun and the Battle of the Somme in 1916, there was no way they could win without the United States of America.
So, Conrad, why isn't there a memorial? I mean, we have memorials to single battles throughout this country, let alone a war where more than 115,000 American lives were lost.
Well, you know, we've got this wave of memorialization that's in the last few decades. You know, the Vietnam Memorial, the Korean War Memorial, the World War II Memorial. Well, all of there are living veterans of those wars to push their memorials. The problem is when this wave, by the time this wave starts, there aren't very many World War I veterans around. And again, it is seen, as we've said numerous times, it's kind of seen as the opening rounds of World War II. It's almost not perceived as an independent event. And we're really only in it for a short time. I mean, relatively, you know, we only fight how many months? It'd be like, you know, was it like April to November? March, April to November. It's a seminal event. It changes the United States. It changes the world. But it just gets wrapped up in World War II, and there aren't any, you know, the veterans are gone too early, and they're just not around to push for their own memorialization.
I think the last living World War I veteran was from Charlestown, West Virginia.
That's right.
And died, 3 years ago?
Yeah, Buckles.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to interview
him.
I
wish you would have.
Actually tried to contact, I spoke with his daughter.
Wow.
Who said that he's just not up to giving interviews, but I really wanted to do that, to have that conversation. But just think about that. That was only a few years ago.
Right.
He lived well into his hundreds. So, you know, he was of old age at that point. I called it the Great War, and it also was described as the war to end all wars. When did those distinctions come along?
Well, that was one of the bumper stickers. The war to end all wars is actually one of the selling points in 1917 and 1918 to justify America's involvement. And it was actually, so we have Wilsonian liberalism. It's basically introduced in 1917, 1918, especially when his 14 points come out in January 1918. And we could see heavy influence 100 years later. Both Bushes were influenced by Wilsonian liberalism, you know, the idea that democratic countries, republics, are not warmongering, and that collective security, NATO, right, is necessary.
United Nations.
Yeah. That's right. But the ultimate, of course, I think, ideological heir would be Barack Obama. So you see, 100 years later, we still have the legacy of the First World War. You know, it strikes me, so the veterans come home, they want to get back on with life. And things are going good, and then a Great Depression, and then World War II, then Korea, then Vietnam, and they're kind of like lost in this hustle and bustle and troubles and just trying to survive, and then they pass on, and now there's a push 100 years later to try to get a monument memorial. It should have happened in the 1920s.
You said something earlier, Doug. You touched on this, and we've actually discussed it on this program, but I wanted to have the two of you explain it a little bit more, and that is the great influenza outbreak that cost millions of lives, too. This occurs at the same time as World War I is being fought. Tell me what happened then.
Well, so we have chemical warfare, gas warfare, and it weakens soldiers' respiratory conditions, obviously, that they're physiological, they're susceptible to this Spanish flu. And the soldiers, it breaks out heavily in 1918. It debilitates part of the Germans in August, on August 8th, 1918.
Doesn't it start actually in the United States? Doesn't it start in military camps?
It's also here in the States. Yeah. And then, okay, it's a plague. And then the soldiers go home, and then they bring it back with them. And people just really don't know how many die. The estimates are between 20 and 100 million. I mean, that's incredible. That's a lot of folks.
Worldwide. Right.
I've got one of the things I brought with my grandfather's diary.
Yeah, I am really looking forward to hearing some of this.
But the thing is, my grandfather is sick the whole time. I mean, the American logistics are not very good. The conditions were terrible. He's always wet. He's always cold. He's always tired. He gets gassed. Eventually, getting gassed, what contributed to his passing. But it just amazes me how often he's sick. And he actually comes back on a hospital ship with influenza at the end. He comes back in 1919 on a big hospital ship with all the other sick that are brought back from France, I remember my grandfather when he used to talk about Paris in the springtime, and he would get this look on his face, and he'd say, "Paris in the springtime is nothing but rain and mud," and that was his memory of World War I, was rain and mud. So the conditions are terrible; they're not really ready for it. Logistics are not very good. All kinds of new being exposed. You know, you're talking about a lot of immigrants being thrown in this army where they're exposed to new germs, and it's this big melting pot of bacteria for everybody. And I mean, it's just it's a perfect conditions to for the epidemic to develop. And again, and these are weakened conditions. These people, guys are at the front for months and months and months. I mean, it's a perfect storm of conditions for this kind of an epidemic to happen.
What was your grandfather's name?
Conrad Ellis Crane. He was a lieutenant in the 55th Coast Artillery, which is basically a Connecticut Coast Artillery unit. Had 155 millimeter French artillery pieces towed by American Holt tractors.
So that diary that you have right there, and I can see even just a few feet away we are from each, it has some yellow pages, but it's in fantastic shape for as old as it is. That has to be a family treasure.
No, it is. I actually have a little photo album, too. These little teeny, I don't know if you've seen them, they did little pictures, these little World War One pictures. They're like an inch and a half by an inch and a half pictures, and he's got a photo album of those as well. And it's a real treasure of images as well as ideas. I mean, he never writes really long passages in the diary. I'll mention one. Doug talked about he's just written a book on American offensive Meuse-Argonne, and the last big push is on 1 November 1918. And my grandfather writes in his diary, "Some noise, sky lit up for miles around, and the hail of steel goes singing into Boche territory with a vengeful note of reparation. Wonderful sight on a dull gray morning."
They write differently in those days, don't they?
They did.
they certainly did. Do. Now, I'm sure you've read through there many times. What stuck out to you? What jumped out to you?
Well, there's one on November 5th, which is the same week. He writes, and they finally get a pause. He said, "Took my first bath in 3 months. Killed some of my oldest cooties, but I still have plenty of young ones left." I mean, it's a tough life these guys are living. And it's the other one that was my favorite is he hadn't met my grandmother yet. So he has a lot of French girlfriends. And he mentions one night he goes to the opera in Paris and there's a Zeppelin raid. And so he says, basically it reads something like, went to Paris with Mademoiselle so-and-so, went to the opera, had a Zeppelin raid, had to go down to the underground during the air raid, had a great time there.
and the two of you have seen combat. So often when war is portrayed as heroic, as romantic, just what you described, Dr. Crane, I mean, I think it says when you hear directly the thoughts of your grandfather, someone who was there in World War One, it's not romantic. It's dirt. It's grime. It's mud. It's danger. It's fear. All those things.
And I'm sure I'll pass it on to Doug because Doug's read so many of these accounts in his books on the Meuse-Argonne and on Sergeant York. I'm sure he can expand on that. But yeah, war is one of the big problems we've got today. Is people start to see war as a video game. Nobody gets hurt. We don't really destroy anything. And instead, war is all chaos and blood and gore and confusion. It's not a video game. It's not laser surgery. It's a terrible event. And somehow we need to remind people of that.
Doug, before you answer, I mentioned earlier that World War One. That there were a lot of firsts in World War One, if not first, very early on, that some things were that was the first time we had seen them. One was trench warfare. And when we're talking about mud, grime, being wet, being cold all the time, how did trench warfare come to be? What was the strategy behind it?
As far as trench warfare in a modern epic, it actually goes back to 1864, the Siege of Petersburg, and also the trench lines around Richmond. And there was European advisors there from all the major powers, including Germany. And I have a quote from one of the Germans from the general staff. And he said, I forbid my officers to learn any lessons to the American way of fighting in 1864, 1865, because they don't know how to fight modern war. And so the lessons applied with of course, the crater outside of Petersburg when a bunch of Pennsylvania miners outside of Pittsburgh dug a tunnel underneath Confederate lines, blew it up, and the failure to attack in the crater instead of on top, and they were stopped by the Confederates. All these lessons that the French and British and Germans are going to have to relearn the hard way in 1915 could have been avoided by not looking and taking a serious thought at previous wars. But okay, 1914, the war breaks out on the Western Front. It's maneuver warfare. Things are going splendidly initially for the Germans, except the British show up there. The British weren't supposed to be there, about 80,000 soldiers from the British Expeditionary Forces. That messes up the German plan. The Belgians fight harder than the Germans had thought. In fact, the Germans had best cased it and said the Belgians will just let us march through their country. No. And so everything was thrown out of whack. And the Germans are advancing towards Paris. There's a gap in the line, and the British and French say identify this gap, throw their several armies into this gap called Battle of the Marne, and they blunt the Germans. And this results into stagnation, where the line falls back a bit, and the Germans stop, and everyone digs in, and there's a race to the sea. Each army's trying to outflank each other, and they're stopped, and then you're going to have several years of attrition-based trench warfare.
And part of this is because these armies are so big. This is the first mass industrial war. You've got these armies are gigantic, and whereas before you had you couldn't cover the whole front. You always had flanks. Now we got the armies are so big they cover the whole front from Switzerland to the North Sea. There's just so many bodies to throw out these. So then the whole dilemma with trench warfare becomes how do you create a flank, and it drives things like the invasions of the Dardanelles and technological things like gas and tanks, but the whole dilemma becomes how do we restore maneuver to this battlefield that is so filled now with all these bodies dug into these trenches.
And so the idea of gas warfare by the Germans in 1915, and the saving grace for the British Army, because the British Expeditionary Force initially was pretty much wiped out, and so they rely upon the Canadians and forces from across the empire to hold the line until they can create a new army in 1916, which is going to be butchered at the Battle of the Somme pretty quickly. But then the Germans try gas warfare, and it breaks the British line. I think Indian troops are defending the sector, but the Germans didn't realize how much success they had, and so they missed an opportunity. Then the British try in 1917 with a mass formation of tanks at Cambrai, and they don't realize they have a great success there, nor do they realize that infantry has to follow closely behind. So all these missed opportunities. One of the leaders of the American of the First Army after Pershing stepped down from it was General Hunter Liggett, and Hunter Liggett said the First World War is basically a series of missed opportunities, because you have introduction of these great innovations there, but then we don't know how to exploit them on either side.
You just listed like three of the when I talked about World War One and some of the modern technology, modern weapons that were used at that time. You just listed three big differences: trench warfare, tanks, also air power. Talk about the air power. Yeah. I mean, those planes, first of all, what were they made of? And they don't exactly look like the sturdiest of vehicles to begin with, but it created something very new in warfare.
Yeah, basically balsa wood in fabric for these aircraft. And initially, they're for reconnaissance. And the Germans and the French have been training with them before the war. And you have zeppelins, you know, airships, and they're used at the tactical level to attack the frontline troops, used in the deep to interdict forces moving forward, and even strategically to bomb London, and the Allies are going to bomb Mannheim and German cities. Paris is being bombed initially at zeppelin raids, as Khan already mentioned, and then the Germans develop a long-range bomber, the Gotha bomber. And it's just an incredible thing. And this sparks ideas, okay, in the next big war, World War II, we'll bomb the epicenters of the populations. Had we had more aircraft, we'll bring the Germans or the British to their knees with strategic bombing, and maybe we could win that with the indirect approach and avoid the trenches.
Dr. Crane, you used a term earlier that I want to follow up on. There are a lot of people that refer to World War I as the first modern war. You disagree with that, and you use the term first industrial war.
Mass industrial war. I mean, there are people who the modern has a lot of baggage. What is the first modern war? I'm not quite sure what modern means. But it is the first mass industrial war. The size of the armies, the massive equipment that goes into them. I mean, there are theorists before the war, Ivan Bloch, among others, who says that warfare is going to be too expensive, countries aren't going to be able to fight these kind of wars. They just won't. They won't happen. We're going to have to get to the center of this great war era of peace because nobody can afford to fight these kind of wars. Well, he was wrong, and it goes on and on and on and on. And that's why you can you go through 4 years of mass carnage.
Everyone thinks of Rosie the Riveter in World War II. In this this film from the Centennial Commission, they say that, and I like the way they describe this, that Rosie the Riveter had a mother. And there were a lot of women that were working in industry in the United States to produce weapons. I mean, you both have talked about how unprepared the United States was, 220,000 troops. You mentioned Belgium. Belgium had a bigger army than the United States when World War I started. But So there were women in the military for the first time. There were women back home here.
Don't exaggerate. There isn't that much in World War One.
I understand.
Women are mostly still in women's roles. Now, they do get suffrage out of this.
Right.
I mean, they do get suffrage. There is a certain societal obligation from what women's contributions that helped get them suffrage. But it's not like World War Two.
No. I just wanted to make the point that for the first time that this had happened. And I just don't want to make it sound like it was just women, because there were millions of men put to work to produce the kind of weaponry and what the United States needed to fight World War One.
It actually also it's beginning of the black migration from the South. It's not as much as in World War II, but you start to get the beginnings of the African Americans moving out of the South towards some of the industries in the North, and that will start this trend. It'll be more in World War II, but it does begin.
But there were black units in World War One too.
Yes, there's the two black divisions, one that's broken up and fights with the French, and then one that is, I guess the Americans do keep one, but it never sees very much action, I understand. The 92nd and 93rd Divisions.
That's right, and it's a bit of shame. Looking back, Pershing, of course, he led the Buffalo Soldiers up to, with Teddy Roosevelt on San Juan Hill in 1899 to dislodge the Spanish in Cuba, and those were black troops. And then he gets in World War One, and he treats them as if they're anathema, and there's no progressivism and the potential that he had. Instead, the French treat the black American forces better than the Americans do. We use them mostly to repair roads and do menial tasks in the back. But they do fairly well when properly led, as most troops do. You know, as far as women, there's one bad situation. A lot of women were used from New York City and North Jersey to put radioactive material on watches and stuff. And these girls didn't know the danger of that, so they goof off. They put it on their fingernails, highly radioactive, put it on their teeth, just goofing off. And they're called the Glow Girls, radium. And then they suffer from cancer in the 30s and 40s. And, of course, they sue the government, and they have a hard time getting any money back to help them get through their last days.
Wow. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Dr. Conrad Crane. He's currently Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle, part of the U.S. Army War College. Dr. Doug Mastriano, who is historian and author, the account of World War One hero Alvin York. And we'll talk a little bit about Alvin York in just a few minutes. But I want to take a step back, if we can. The start of World War One. The United States, as you mentioned earlier, the United States was only involved in the fighting for a few months. It started in 1914, often looked upon as starting on June 28th, 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Countess Sophie, assassinated in Sarajevo in Bosnia. Now, many people 100 years later, more than 100 years now, would look at that and say, how did that start a world war?
Well, tangled in alliances. So he was assassinated. Ferdinand was assassinated by Gavilio Princip. Him and seven other assassins were lined up along the river in Sarajevo near the Latine Bridge. And actually, one of the assassins threw a bomb at first at Ferdinand's car. And Ferdinand deflected with his arm, and it blew up and injured soldiers behind him in a trail vehicle. And Ferdinand came out and was worried about the soldiers and shipped them off to the hospital. He went to City Hall in Sarajevo. He yelled at the mayor and then calmed down. They had a meeting, and on his way back, they took a wrong turn and stopped in front of Schiller's Cafe, where Gavilio Princip, one of the eight assassins, out of frustration, went in to get a sandwich, and a friend stopped him. And while he's talking to his friend, guess who stops literally? Ferdinand's like, he went the wrong way. He yells at his driver. They stop, and he pulls out his pistol and murders both the Archduke and his wife. Okay, this is a problem between Serbian separatists and the Serb nation against the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but the Austro-Hungarians are allied with the Germans. The Russians see themselves as the defender of the Slavs. This is confusing. The Slavic people are our people, and the Russians say, you better not attack our brothers, Austria-Hungary. Our Serbs are our brothers. And, of course, the Russians mobilize. This is a threat to Germany. Germany knows that Russia and France have a secret treaty, not so secret. And if we fight Russia, we're going to have to fight the French. So let's preemptively, it's now called the Schlieffen Plan, swing through Belgium, knock Paris out in 6 weeks. Actually, do that in 1940, not 1914. And then put all our troops in 47 days or less, put all our troops on a train, ship them over to Russia, because it takes the Russians a long time to mobilize. Well, guess what? No, the French had invested the past 10 years in Russian rails, and the Russians mobilized a lot faster, 2 weeks faster than Germans had planned, and the Russians are marching across East Prussia. So things go out of hand right away.
Well, how did Germany become the main combatant, though? I mean, when we talk about World War One, usually we talk about the Allies, United States, France, and Britain fighting Germans. How did Germany become the main combatant?
Kaiser Wilhelm tied himself to the Austro-Hungarian dynasty, and when the Austro-Hungarians went to Kaiser Wilhelm in the midst of this crisis, well, if Russia attacks, what are we going to do? And Kaiser Wilhelm supposedly gave this blank check. Yeah, do what you have to do. I'll back you up.
The recent historiography, though, is looking at it more that the Germans knew what they were doing. They basically looked at the world situation. I mean, this is a time, of course, of social Darwinism, when every country's war is good for nations. The greatest nations will rise to the top. You know, the race for empire. Everybody's competing with each other. And the Germans look at the correlation of forces, and they say, well, this is the time we can win a war. You look at the British are only loosely linked with the other. We've got France and Russia, but if we can knock Russia out, then we can eventually knock France out quick. Then we can get the Russians. This is our time. This is so the Germans. Again, the reason looking at the German archives a little bit more, the sense is that it's not a chance thing. The Germans know where this can go and think this is their time where the correlation of forces is such that they can actually win this thing.
So let's go back to the United States during this period. The United States tried to stay neutral. And in fact, the United States only got involved in the war, started fighting in 1917, 3 years after World War One had started. I know, Doug, when we've talked before, that you have been very critical of President Wilson. And tell me why. Why do you criticize Woodrow Wilson and his attempts for the United States? By the way, the United States was supplying both sides in this war before the United States entered the war. But why are you critical of Wilson?
Well, I'm a bit critical of him because although the signs were evident, I don't fault him from trying to stay out of the war early on because you just heard how confusing. You know, why should we get involved in a war? We have no idea why it all came together. Why should we care about an Archduke assassinated in Sarajevo? And why are the Germans fighting? What's this with the Russians and French? Confusing. Okay. 1914, and President Wilson issues a statement within days of the German attack of Belgium that we're going to be neutral in word, deed, and thought. But the problem is, yes, we're willing to sell our goods to the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, the French and British. But the French and British, they're blessed with geography. They're interdicting American ships and then paying for the
They're smart. Yeah.
They're securing the vessels. The British wanted to be rough with the Americans, as they had been in the 1800s, and just kind of basically Shanghai and take over the ship. And the French are like, no, we want to woo the Americans. So they're paying twice, actually, for the cargo. But the Germans are, and the Kaiser's like, this is not fair. And so I have to starve the British. So the Germans start sinking ships with their submarines and other innovation, and Americans are dying. And by 1917, after Lusitania, the combined loss of American lives is over 200. And Woodrow Wilson tries to talk himself out of this instead of preparing the nation for a war that might happen. It looks like it's going to happen. In fact, the commandant of the U.S. Army War College, he begins planning in 1916. What do we need to do if America's mobilized for war? What should the United States Army prepare for? To think about war, pragmatic measures. And Woodrow Wilson orders him to stop because you're warmongering.
I mean, but it's interesting because that's one of these strategic calculations the Germans make is they it gets to 1917 and they decide, and I guess January they decide to go to unrestricted submarine warfare, and they're told, you know, this is going to bring the Americans into the war, and they say, well, we're going to gamble that we can knock the British out of the war before the Americans are going to come into the war, and even then they still got to get their ships across the Atlantic, and we can probably prevent that. So again, they make a lot of assumptions about unrestricted submarine warfare that don't come into fruition. And instead, that's the final straw that actually gets the Americans into the war.
And we invite this attack by not preparing. With a 200,000-man basically colonial frontier army, the Germans are like, well, it's going to take them a year to mobilize, and the Kaiser's right. Yep. And then to make matters worse, of course, we have the famous Zimmerman telegram, where, of course, Foreign Secretary Zimmerman in Berlin sends a communique to Mexico City, hey, attack America, we'll back you to take the Southwest. And of course, Zimmerman's asked, did you send that? Because it's the British sent it to the Americans, and the press is like, this is propaganda. And he's like, of course I sent that. He's like, what are you, nuts?
Yeah. Yeah, when you say the Southwest, I mean, there was actually a plan the Germans were suggesting to Mexico to invade the United States to take back Arizona, New Mexico, was Texas?
Part of Texas and part of California. And of course, that's a straw that breaks the camel's back. You have the unrestricted submarine warfare that Khan talked about, a plan to invade the United States through Mexico, and even Woodrow Wilson can't talk himself out of this one.
So at the time, I imagine that there were many Americans who wanted to stay out of this, not just the politicians. So you just talked about the reasons that the United States as a nation got involved in the war. What about Americans themselves? Because, again, you see when we see those reels, those movie reels of sweethearts and wives saying goodbye to their loved ones, those who have joined the armed forces and those who were drafted, 3 million drafted during World War I as well. I mean, so was there this, I don't know, upsurge of nationalism, of patriotism, or just what?
Well, I mean, you've got the ship sinking, as Doug mentioned, are in all newspapers. You actually have a very well-orchestrated propaganda, it's an information campaign by the government also to try to get people fired up and to control their emotions and try to explain to them what's going on. And so there are all kinds of campaigns to get people in it. I mean, so and generally, again, the Americans see the deaths and the ship sinkings are all over the newspapers, and the Germans actually, I guess there's some sabotage attempts, I think, at some of the ammunition factories. I think
that's right.
So, well, in New York,
So that starts to come to the fore, and so there's, there are things to push. It has taken a while, but Americans have watched the war develop, and there's also the British are masters of propaganda. There's all kinds of pictures of shooting Belgian nurses and raping women across the advance across Belgium, and there's all these things about the atrocities of Central Powers. And
did that really happen, or was that just propaganda?
Oh, there was some truth to it. I mean, it was exaggerated, but there were some miscarriages of justice, I guess you'd say it, during the German advance. But it's all played up very much in the press. Americans are aware of it. But it's really, I would argue, and I'll let Doug jump in, that it's just the unrestricted submarine warfare that really gets played up. And really, this is a violation of American sovereignty. You're killing American citizens. You said you weren't going to do it, and then all of a sudden they turn around and they do it. The Germans seem duplicitous. At the same time, all the economic ties are with Britain and France because we can't get to Germany and the Central Powers. So there's all kinds of links there as well. I mean, all momentum is pushing us towards being this associated power.
In May 1916, when the Lusitania is sunk and 198 Americans are among the scores killed, Woodrow Wilson's only recourse is not to prepare the Army or Navy for war, but to send a stern note to Kaiser Wilhelm that basically says, if you do this again, we'll take this as being deliberately provocative to the United States. I mean, oh my goodness. He's just like dithering, daydreaming, and giving speeches. It's in Brisbane, Australia, they have a spoof of President Wilson. Basically, they say war is as far from President Wilson as his typewriter is, because all he does is type out stern notes to the Kaiser. Don't do that again. We'll be really angry.
But again, the Germans, after this initial note, the Germans do back off in 1916. That's again, it's... Then in January, they say, we're going to do it again. And that goes right. You know, if Wilson said, that's going to be provocative, they're thrown at in his face. And like Doug said, you can't avoid that.
And the Germans are tripping all over themselves. So the American journalists say, well, let us go to your trenches and see the war from your perspective. And the Germans are like, no. But the French or British are like, yes, come on in. You can see our side of the story. And it's and the Germans foul up this whole Lusitania thing. They actually mint a coin as a souvenir to give away to their population in honor of the sinking Lusitania. And they honor the captain who sank the civilian vessel. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Once the United States did enter the war, we were right in the middle of it. In what way?
Well, I mean, we obviously we sent 2 million troops. The shipping, but again, we never quite get industry mobilized. I mean, we're using my grandfather's shooting French artillery pieces. We're using French tanks. A lot of the equipment is coming from the other associated powers, but it's. I mean, any historian of the war, I work with Bob Doty at West Point, who's probably the leading American French, historian of the French experience. And he says, even though the British and the French may have looked down on the Americans' tactical prowess, it was these hundreds of thousands of fresh young Americans, they're all over 6 feet tall, they all look like giants, that just restores morale the Allied size. And just the Germans, even though they're shooting a lot of them down, they say, where are these guys coming from? They're all savages. They're all... It basically restores the morale on the Allied side, and the Central Powers just see millions of Americans just this wave of Americans just coming at them that seems endless.
So was it sheer numbers, or were American soldiers just very good fighters?
Well, Doug's the one who studied it. I'll let Doug have that. He studied Alvin York. Alvin York was pretty good.
Well, so the material, how America contributed greatest in this whole war, because as Khan rightly said, that we had a big bar and seal off the French and British. Actually, the French were the arsenal democracy in World War One, and they had the tanks and the aircraft, and most of our equipment was French. Some British, but mostly French equipment we're using. General Patton, Lieutenant Colonel Patton in 1918 is going to be leading a squadron of Renault French tanks forward. He's going to be on foot. He's not in a tank. But anyway, the so what was material contribution to the United States to win this war was the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. It's one of America's biggest battles. Almost 2 million men, 1.2 million Americans, 600,000 French fought in the Meuse-Argonne region. And it's in this bulge between Verdun and the Argonne Forest. And it's at the bottom of this German bulge that had been there since 1914. And it's the most important sector for the Allies because just 60 kilometers behind the Meuse-Argonne is the rail network, the city of Mezières and Sedan. And if the Americans can seize that rail or threaten that, it will force the Germans to commit their 24 strategic reserve divisions on the Western Front to stop the Americans. And guess what? And Foch, by the way, he asked Pershing, would you be okay with using your brand new army to attack this very difficult sector? And Pershing's like, yes, that's why we're here. So 20,000 casualties a week by the Americans. It's a churn. It's a bloodbath. But it has the effect. Foch launches the Americans on 26 September 1918 in the Meuse-Argonne, and it panics the German headquarters. Hindenburg and Ludendorff have to send the reserves, and it opens a way for the British and French to break through further to the north.
Talk about Alvin York, because, I mean, this was truly an American hero, and Doug Mastriano, you are the authority on Alvin York. Tell me about Alvin York.
Alvin York is such an intriguing story because he really reflects and personifies of what Americans back then thought of themselves. You know, kind of self-made pioneer, rough and tumble kind of guy. He grew up in a Christian family, but in 1911, his dad died, got kicked by a mule he was shoeing in the blacksmith shop. So Alvin York has to take over the family, can't handle the pressure, so he starts going up to the Kentucky border, 3 miles from Pall Mall, Tennessee, kicks back, blows off steam in these blind tigers, these drinking establishments where you don't go to watch a soccer game on a big screen TV. You're there to get drunk and chase girls. And these guys are armed with knives and guns, so every month there's at least one death from a fight. And so Alvin York's mom, she's really worried about him, that he's going to die, sends a pastor to talk to him. He will not have nothing to do with the pastor. But a neighbor girl catches his eye, Gracie Williams. And so he starts going to church, gets saved on 1 January 1915. Life is going great. His life radically changes. And then in April 1917, he gets a draft card. And so he writes down in block 12 on a draft card, do you claim exemption? He goes, yes, I don't want to fight because it's against his religious beliefs as a Christian. And a draft board's like, no, you're going. So he goes with great confusion, and he goes over to France with great doubt and confusion. But then on that one day, 8 October 1918, he's faced with a German machine gun. His friends are being killed around him. His best and only friend in the army, actually, Corporal Murray Savage from upstate New York, is killed. And he says, I got to stop the killing. He charges up the hill, takes out a German machine gun, kills 19 Germans in that position, comes back down the hill, fights off a bayonet attack, and it results in breaking the German line in the Argonne Forest, a forest they've held for 4 years. And I believe I can make the case that he changes the outcome of the war for the Americans in the South.
We only have a few minutes left. You've mentioned a couple of the battles briefly. What are some of the major battles that should be remembered from World War One?
Oh, gee. I think one of the worst battles in military history is Passchendaele. I mean, there's so many bad ones. Verdun, million casualties of Verdun, the Somme, the massacre of the British, the first couple of days of the Somme, Passchendaele, the mud. If you go to the Canadian War Museum, there's one of the sets there is Passchendaele, and basically it just shows bodies sinking into the mud. I mean, it just there are just so many awful battles of mass casualties that it seems almost pointless.
These remembered in Europe?
Oh, yes. The Europeans remember. The British lose a generation of leaders in World War One. One of the complaints that it's hard to find leaders for the British Army in World War II because they lost so many of their outstanding leaders in World War One. I mean, the French never recover. Arguably, the performance of the French Army is World War II because of the great losses of leadership they have in World War One. There's long-term impacts of this.
35 million people, and I've seen figures as high as 37 million people dying in World War One.
And that's just the military casualties, basically. I mean, that's there's more civilian casualties. I mean, if you look at that, some of the Austro-Hungarian army mobilized about 8 million men. 90% are casualties of the Austrian army. I mean, it's 65% of the German army, 76% of the French and Russian armies. I mean, the casualty numbers are immense. And again, this is your best and brightest. These are, in most cases, everybody volunteers. This is their national destiny. And the best and the brightest go to the front, and the best and the brightest die. Mm.
Something that I'm glad we had the opportunity to speak about, a time in American history that probably many more Americans should know a whole lot more about. But thank you, Dr. Doug Mastriano, who is historian and author, Dr. Conrad Crane, with the Chief of Historical Services for the Army Heritage and Education Center. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
No, thank you. Enjoyed it a lot.